Hello and welcome to episode 439 of the Crate and Crowbar, being recorded on the 5th of November 2024. Literally nothing else is happening tonight. Although, if you do hear a few bangs and pops in the background, that is just because in my nation, we celebrate the burning of a Catholic religious sectarian reasons. We all get very excited about it, and it's a great day out for all the kids. Joining me tonight is Mr. Marsh Davies.
Hello.
And Mr. Tom Senior.
Good evening.
Good evening indeed. I sound very, very Radio 4 saying that. Good evening indeed. Welcome to Front Row. We're going to be talking about God of War.
God forbid.
Yeah. I think we've all been playing the same game, haven't we?
Yes, we have.
We have. I feel as though I've been playing it since the dawn of time, actually. It's kind of my impression of it. This is God of War. Ragnarok is the one that we've been playing. But I played the first one. Did you guys play the first one as well?
Yes, yeah. In fact, that was the reason I was so excited
to
play
same.
The second one. And sadly, I feel like I'm not now quite as excited about it as I was before I started playing.
We've all played the first game, but the second game, I think we're going to have slightly sort of less enthusiastic opinions about this one, because we had a bit of a chat in Discord about it. And though it is still a good game about chonking a billion goons into little pieces with a cool frost axe and other tools, it's just kind of, I don't know, like, it felt us all, I feel like, based on the chat that we had, it felt us all feeling, left us all feeling a bit exhausted. Is that
I think so. I mean, one thing I would say up top is that people really love, like, properly love this game, right?
Yeah.
If you Google around for it, you know, IGN gave it a 10 out of 10. And I think it's a game that if you play it, you know, I can imagine if you were waiting for this game after loving the last God of War game, and then this one comes out and you played like a bunch of it on the day of release and then complete it over that weekend or whatever, I can imagine that experience feeling pretty special. Like, you've missed these characters, you want to see what happens to them, you want more of this world, you want more. And in terms of more, if that is your main criteria, then I think this game serves you up pretty much, you know, more than you could ever imagine, really, in those terms. And so, like, I sort of want to respect that kind of engagement with the game, because I think it is something that it's very easy to miss coming to the game a couple of years later, as it is now. Because I think, you know, game developers have that in mind, I think, you know, they have that kind of, and there's something kind of joyful about, you know, I remember when Final Fantasy VIII came out and I played it, I think, for 18 hours nonstop before losing my mind and more or less stopping and never going back to it. However, that first 18 hours was, you know, something really special. Or Metal Gear Solid 2, Sons of Liberty, like, that came out. I played it up until the moment where it all goes weird and the game starts talking to you and telling you to turn the game off and that you must be too tired. And literally thought I was going mad because it was 4 in the morning, and turned off my PlayStation 2 and then went and looked in my bathroom mirror and hallucinated myself as a solid snake.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I'd gone completely mad. But, like, wonderfully valuable things about that experience, right? And I think Thor, Ragnarok. I keep trying to call it Thor. It's not called Thor. It's called God of War.
He's the best one, though.
There's another thing called Thor Ragnarok, and this isn't it. But yeah, I think a couple of years later, it is a game that kind of shines a little less brightly, I think, when you play it. Full disclosure, I haven't actually played much of this game by percentages. I played the first 10, 12 hours of it.
You're but a babe in the woods.
Yeah,
but I was able to kind of get a sense of what happens after that point. I mean, it was funny because I kind of I played that first kind of 10 or 12 hours, and I was like, wow, there's a lot of characters here and a lot of backstory they're covering. Like, I guess this is the bulk of the setup to what the denouement of the game is. Like, oh no, like, there's like three more acts of setup before, like, there's so many more characters to meet after that point, and so much more kind of walking around and talking to people to do. And I think probably for most of us, that's where some of the issues we have are.
Yeah, it's one of the few. It's one of the few 20 act stories.
Absolutely,
that go in ever decreasing circles. Is a mean way to put it, but yeah, Marsh, sorry.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I would also like to say, as Jamie did, there are many things to admire about this game, and I did overall enjoy it. Then, and a lot of the charms of the first game remain. Both in terms of the kind of individual characters, their writing, their performances, and also in the combat and other things, other mechanical aspects of the game are very enjoyable. But there's just, but I'd like to go back to God of War 1, because not God of War 1-1, but God of War, the new God of War 1, because I think like that throws into kind of relief a lot of the things that I felt were underwhelming about God of War Ragnarok. And it's like, I really enjoyed the first God of War game. Like primarily because it was, there's a huge shock of the new, right? You see Kratos being reimagined, and I felt like throughout God of War Ragnarok, I had to keep on reminding myself what a triumph was that was, because I'm used to the idea of Kratos being who he is now. But like, prior to the reboot, Kratos was probably one of the worst characters ever conceived in any kind of fictional context. Like, he's just the most puerile, childish power fantasy with this awful beard. And it's so dated. And, you know, like, I guess if you were like a 13-year-old boy in 2005, Kratos might have briefly seemed cool, like as an avatar of like unexamined muscular power. And it, like, wallowing in this horrible hodgepodge of fantasy mulch, mythical mulch rather, like just all these mythic references jumbled together myth with mulch. No kind of myth mulch. But he's just the worst, emptiest vessel, probably one of the worst characters, second only to the entire cast of Twisted Metal. But with this reboot, they like...
Such a peculiar and specific burn on Twisted Metal.
But they imagine him as this character straight out of the gate who's deeply conflicted by his own anger, like he's struggling to form this a healthy or any kind of relationship with his son. He's got a son, gosh, that's exciting. And he's bewildered by the grief of losing this partner. And I know that we're now well into gaming's sad dad era, like the Druckmannocene, if you will. But like, and all of that sounds a little kind of try hard now, but it was executed with such panache and earnestness in that first game. And like, while that game was like egregiously padded as well, like by at least 12 hours of just whopping these palette swap Draugr, even though that was true, the shock of the new, that central story was really a powerful motor.
There's that brilliant film called The Shootist. You ever seen that movie, The Shootist? It's like it's a Western made right at the end of John Wayne's career. And it opens with a montage of scenes that they've taken from previous Western movies that John Wayne made, of him being this like badass outlaw. And then the movie is about a dying gunslinger. And John Wayne was quite close to death when he made the movie. And it's kind of one of those great kind of prototypical kind of sort of stories where it's like, this guy has tried to leave his violent past behind, but it kind of draws him back in ways that he can't control. And it's a movie that kind of asks the question, can you ever truly escape from that, right? And God of War has almost, you know, exactly the same structure. And it's a kind of time-honored structure. And I think God of War 1, the original never seen before God of War, it did a really good job of, it had the dynamic of it and the shock of the new, but it also had this like past in essentially another medium, you know, that it could draw on for a sense of mystery, which I think was really, really clever and apt to kind of reboot the series somewhat, but not entirely, to kind of take the previous adventures of Kratos as canonical, but something that he wishes wasn't canonical, right? Something that he wishes and has tried very hard to leave behind.
He's explicitly ashamed of them. He's like explicitly, he won't talk to Atreus, his son, about them. The points of the various heads he ripped off and the various gods that he defeated to get to the top of, Mount Olympus. But also, I think it was a huge success, the first game, in actually making Atreus himself interesting, where the kid wasn't simply a device or a point of leverage for Kratos' story. There was like serious stuff happening with who Atreus is, who he turns out to be, and where both him and Kratos fit in the pantheon in this new universe. And all of that was like super well delivered, I think, and just with great performances. Okay, great performances in the new game as well. But that's a really great story, both on Kratos' side and Atreus' side. I mean, those are the two main characters you're hanging out with. In the first game, it just really pays off, I think.
Well, all of that is just right, so new out of the gate in the first game. But a lot of those charms, like Atreus is still a great character in the second game, I think. But
yeah,
the difference is that not only are you forced to recognize with these new, more meaningful characters, but you are on a clear quest from the start. Like, your wife's dying wish is to have her ashes scattered from the tallest mountain in the realms. And it's not going to be easy there, because almost immediately you set out on this quest, these Norse gods themselves take an interest in you and start interfering with you. And you know, what do they want? You know, what relationship did your wife have with them? What's the, what does it mean for your son? Can you protect him? Should you protect him? And all these questions are like really quickly posed, and you're given such a clear motivation to pursue and maybe answer them along the way. And like, just to compare that with God of War Ragnarok, like, I know it has a hard task of picking up the pieces, but even if you watch the recap, I was kind of uncertain about where things left off, and it's difficult to orientate yourself again. I mean, that's not really the fault of the game. That's just how things open. But like, what's the motivating incident in the second game? What is the question that it's answering? I would summarize it as follows. There are some guys. Should we do anything about them? and that's a question that the game doesn't try at all to answer for the first 8 hours, at least. Hmm. And then when the answer comes, it's maybe. Like, I'm not wedded to the hero's journey or anything. Like, I'm excited for people and games, particularly, to mix that stuff up. But oh my God, it feels bewilderingly purposeless for far too long. And it's confusing, I think, because like, the dialogue is often rather good, and the writers know these characters' voices so well, and they evoke them and their relationships with skill. In some ways, it's just still a good hang. Like, it's nice to be around these characters and hear them chat to each other, but it's just not quite enough to justify you milling around periodically decapitating frogmen and elves for no real clear purpose.
I find it kind of funny that one of the great motivating factors in the first game is that Balder comes to your house, and like, so Kratos is there with Atreus, and they're just sort of trying to live their lives quietly, but this weird, wiry, scary, immortal, pain-obsessed dude just rocks up at your front door and knocks. And to me, that's like super faithful to a lot of that is a lot of Norse mythology, is Odin just rocking up and knocking on your door. Like, it's just, the gods could be anyone and anywhere. And I thought that the execution of Baldur in particular in the first game was genuinely scary. And I felt a very instinctive urge to sort of join with Kratos and Atreus in sort of defending their patch. And that's indeed laid out by the sort of like mystic totems that are put out by Kratos' partner. And they fall down. That's what eventually forces them out in order to sort of basically just try and regain their security. In the second game, in Ragnarok, it's replaced by this like grand prophecy idea, and I get really frustrated by grand prophecy plots where it's pushing characters into a prophecy that's told to the characters, and then they try to avoid the fate of the prophecy, and then in so doing, they fall back. The fates were right all along, back into the tract of the prophecy, and the story continues. The anxiety about following prophecy or not is deeply uninteresting to me. It's like it's absolutely nothing to me. Like I do not care if they fulfill some sort of destiny or not. I don't care if they get to their destination, but I do care about the characters. And what I think the game, what Ragnarok does so often, is it presents antagonism between the characters and then just sort of resolves it into nothing. I think Freya is the best example of this in the first third of the game. And Freya, I think we've talked quite well without spoiling anything, so I don't want to sort of like say too much, but she has a very good reason to hate you in God of War Ragnarok. And you are being chased by her literally the opening scene of the game. Like she's a god pursuing you as your, you know, your wolf-drawn cart is rushing through the wilderness and you're fighting her off. She's an amazing character. She's still, even, you know, after the sequences, like, she's a great character throughout, incredibly well acted. The performance is beautiful. But then all that sort of like opposition goes away. It sort of melts away as part of the story. So you're into this mulch of where you're not against anyone and no one is against anyone. And this is sort of, I worried that like this is a bit of immaturity on my part because I wanted a fight. I wanted something to fight. Yeah. That's definitely like part of my instincts for playing so many games like this where you're expecting the mini bosses that lead up to the big boss and the inevitable kind of boss rush that happens at the end and the you know, the typical escalation, which I think they're trying to subvert here, but definitely. But like at the same time, what you're actually doing in the game for the vast majority of the time is whacking things with an axe until they disintegrate. And that is like, there's supposed to be this fury and this anger. And if it's directionless in the plot, it ends up just being a kind of mulch when you're kind of, you just mulch through enemies until you get to the next cutscene where everyone makes friends. And then you mulch your way to the next cutscene where everyone kind of like resolves things a little bit. I just wanted is a bit more, you know, bite, a bit more spark.
All this brings us, I think, inevitably, to the movie Frozen 2, sequel to Disney's Frozen 1.
Of course.
Because they're almost exact one-to-one equivalents, Frozen 1 and God of War 1, in that they both involve quite simple premises, i.e. a journey to the top of a mountain in order to seek some form of redemption, retribution, solace. But they're also journeys inwards to discover, you know, one's own purpose and one's own design for the world. And they both do it incredibly well, incredibly effectively. God of War and Frozen, both, you know, really great pieces of storytelling that go for simplicity, but hit their marks hard, right? They really hit their marks hard. And they're both kind of immortal for it, right? They're kind of, the characters in that movie and the characters in that game are kind of, you know, they have a place in people's souls in a funny kind of way after that point, because there's something about them that they brought to the fore. I think what happens in instances like the Frozen franchise and in God of War is that there is a desire amongst the creators that you can't really blame them for to protect that, right? They want to protect what people loved and what people appreciated, and they want to bring that back to them in more richer, developed form. So Frozen 2 is a movie which is basically about Elsa trying to understand who she is. Like, why has she got these ice powers? You know, what's her kind of purpose in life? What is the kind of prophecy that was said about her? And kind of this, like, leads them on this journey to the kind of wherever the fuck lands where she came from. And the movie very, very quickly descends into people wondering what the point of themselves is. And I think that is a really, really tricky place to be, because I understand why you get there, because you don't want these characters to just be shouting at each other and falling out. And there's a surprising amount of kind of maturity between Kratos and Atreus in the game, particularly in that first act that I played through. They're trying to be honest with each other. They're trying not to lie to each other. There's a distinct lack of secret keeping for quite a long time, or when they do keep secrets, there's a good reason for it. And that is sort of true of all the characters through the game, even the baddies. They are all gifted this kind of level of depth and complexity, but they all suffer because of that, because there's a lack of purpose to them. And in Frozen 2, like, it gets maddening, particularly if you're watching it with a kid, because after a while, you realize this movie is so protective over its characters that it doesn't really want to let anything happen to them. It doesn't want them to ever fall out. It doesn't ever really want them to do anything, really. There is just this kind of trudge towards an understanding of one's own nature. And though I think that can be an interesting part of a plot, and it's an interesting part of the first game, right, of God of War 1 or Frozen 1, it needs to be part of a structure that kind of supports it. And I think the problem with God of War Ragnarok is that there just is a lack of purpose there, and that is kind of fatal to the storytelling. Like, I was really trying to fight against it as I played through the first hours of it, but I found myself being bored. It was when Freya, who was the villain in the first game, was kind of, she forgives you for the thing that's happened in the first game. And I thought, yeah, like, this actor is beautifully portraying this moment and this capture of her face and the scene and everything around it is perfect. No fault whatsoever, really. But the structural place it takes in the story of kind of 10 hours in, 15 hours in, this character offering you absolution from a place of understanding, fine, I get it. But where's the conflict? Everyone's too meek with each other. And I think, as I say, I think that comes from a really like honest and creative, honest desire to protect your creations. But I do think it does kind of castrate the story. And, you know, Frozen 2 gets by because its songs are brilliant, right? It's got really, really good songs.
I was about to say.
You can't fault them. Fantastic songs, fantastically sung, including like a really good like power ballad that Jonathan Groff sings. And, you know, God of War has got brilliant fights and brilliant spectacle, but within a structure that doesn't let them speak to their highest potential, I think.
But Frozen 2 is also 2 and a bit hours, whereas these, even the sluggish plot beats that exist in Ragnarok are kind of stretched thin across
30 hours?
Yeah, if you're going as fast as you possibly can, probably 30, 40 hours to motor to the end. And there's loads of extra stuff you can do if you want to, if you're really into the combat system. But yeah, I mean, that bit where you get forgiven by Freya, like, is preceded by a bit where you're playing solo with Atreus, and you go, like, he's a pretty good climber, and he's sort of climbing around and finding his feet, literally, and that's also obviously a metaphor, but he gets to Freya, and it's a really tense scene. Like, it's a really good scene when he finds her, and she binds him in vines, and, you know, she obviously has seen him coming a million miles away. And you do get, like, a really good scene, but then that's one scene. And then it's probably about 12 hours until the next interesting scene. Like, as well executed as these things are and as well cast and well written as they are, I don't think like a story like this could, like, it's structurally, it just like a bridge just collapses in the middle as you're trying to get from A to B.
It's funny that prophecy stuff, because like there are ways to make that dramatic, and the way that you described, which, yeah, you dislike, is that there's that inherent irony that, you know, exists in the plays of Euripides and you know, Greek and Nordic myth as well, the poetic Edda or whatever, where, you know, somebody tries to avoid prophecy and their efforts to avoid it ultimately lead to them fulfilling it. And like that, I understand why that's like a hoary old trope now and quite tiresome. But in this, like, confoundingly, their choices to neither pursue Ragnarok nor attempt to avoid it. Like, they don't do either. They just wander around on like a fact-finding mission for 25 hours until it just sort of happens to them. And like at 16 hours in, someone literally says, So we're just keeping blindly on then, hoping we don't walk into Ragnarok. And that is exactly what happens. And like, yeah, amazingly, when plot beats do occur, when they finally occur and something like there's a moment where stakes seem to be set, they're then taken back. Like, there's a part where a character, not to avoid all spoilers, gets separated from the rest, and the other characters believe he's in danger. And, like, finally, they start acting. Like, they start reacting to that. They have a purpose. There's, you know, there's a situation that they want to get him out of and rescue them. And then, but then that character just gets out of the situation, no problem, just comes home. And that's undone. It's just like, oh no, delete that, undone. And they go back to sort of stumbling around. And at the end, like, you really wonder why any of it happened. And like, yeah, you can say, oh, it was prophecy, but it's just, you know, it was just nothing happened. They it felt completely unearned, accidental. And then it's all packaged up as though it was like a win for justice, but it doesn't feel like you really did anything. And the only roadblock to that justice is Odin, who's like a really likable character.
Yeah,
evil, like, and he's the other thing about him, he's looking for answers. Yeah. And after like 25 fucking hours of wandering around aimlessly, you really sympathize with that.
Yes, yeah. I feel as though they might have made him too good. Like,
yeah.
But both, well, like,
he's played by Richard, yeah, Schiff, which is it's brilliant performance. I think whoever was directing him on his days in the studio had a big piece of cardboard with the words "more mints."
So good though.
I love the minciness of his performance and the petulance of it, and that kind of tempered with his, like, you know, his great intellect and kind of patience as well. It's like a real, it's a real Shakespearean performance and a Shakespearean character. And Richard Schiff is clearly having the time of his life with it, or maybe having a miserable time. It's hard to tell, but like, something's happening and he's great.
I mean, you sense the danger in him as well, right?
Yeah.
I mean, is kind of avuncular and affable, and he is very patient despite all these slights against him. But you know that there's steel under there. It is a fantastic performance, a fantastic characterization. And I think because it's so mesmerizing, even though he's set up to be like the heel, like, you don't want him to really be defeated because he's like one of the only interesting things happening. But I think all of this is like, it's intentional. Like, there is it is all to an end. And like, I do applaud that it's, you know, they're trying to reimagine Kratos as a pacifist. Like, he is guilty about his past. He's trying to choose anything but war. And like, I think that is cool, honestly. That is that's an interesting thing to do with the character. But I think, like, even within that framing, they could find some motivation or purpose for him. Like, he could resist actively. He could try to escape. But the one thing he can't do is not act at all. Because action is literally the only form of participation that the player has in this story. Yeah. And that's what they choose, bizarrely, like, right up until the very end, right up until like the climax, Ragnarok is happening, and spoilers for the next 30 seconds, they start it, and then they have a moment of introspection like 10 minutes in, and then bail on the whole idea. And like, somehow that's meant to be satisfying and noble and not momentously irritating. Yeah. But I'm afraid I found it momentously irritating.
Gosh.
There's a moment, the best moment in the bit the amount of it I played by far, and the moment that kind of took my breath away, is minor spoilers for the next minute or so. It's a moment when you're in the elf world. Is that Alfheim? Have I got that right?
Yeah.
Elf realm.
It's elf one realm. Of the Heims.
One word, elf realm. And there's a moment where Atreus and another character are bickering away, and you've got the kind of, let's say, essentially the life stream behind you, right, from Final Fantasy VII. I guess the Norse got to that one first, rather than Squaresoft. whatever the hell, the life stream. And then there's a moment where Kratos hears something from the light, and the music swells. He turns around and slowly walks towards the light in silhouette.
Yeah, yeah.
And it took my fucking breath away. It's beautiful. The way that the light kind of engulfs him and like shrinks his form in a funny kind of way. So he just sort of seems like this ordinary sad man being, in previous games, that was where he kind of encountered, I think, the spirit of his wife. And like, she's not there anymore. So what's he walking towards? And I honestly took my breath away. Beautiful. So much done. And what's quite funny is Atreus and the other character are fucking bickering away while it's happening, and they literally lower the volume on them. Just like, yeah. And to have like Kratos, I was like, shut up, shut the fuck up. And he walks away from them. And it just spoke to me so much more in that moment. It's such a beautiful moment for the character, because it speaks of something beyond the kind of mess they're in at this time in the game. It speaks of like a character who has kind of hopes and wishes and desires which aren't, just endlessly altruistic and endlessly concerned. You know, he's got to be able to be selfish. He's got to be able to yearn for things that aren't just safety, boy, all that sort of stuff. And that moment just blew me away with how good it was. I don't know how much of that kind of train is paid off in the rest of the game, but for me, it was by far and away the most affecting moment. And then a little bit later in that same sequence, when you leave that area, he kind of has a little last backward glance towards the light. But yeah, I thought that was glorious. It almost made me think of, like, there's a lot of Tom Bombadil chat going around, a lot of Bomber discourse doing the rounds right now. Because he's, I can't spoil a certain series on television at the moment. I haven't even seen it, but I believe there is an appearance of a certain woodsy folk lad.
It's been Tolkien for many years.
I'm looking at Marsh asking for confirmation on the Bomber.
I haven't seen series two of Rings of Power, but I believe he's played by Rory Kinnear.
Right,
And I know he keeps his dick in his pants. In Men.
What is the point of Rory Kinnear? If he's
false
not sir?
Noses and getting his wang out. That's what I want from Rory Kinnear.
And using the word slits. That's horrible. But yeah, I bring up Bombadil, not to praise him. I bring up Bombadil because, like, I always liked that bit in the book. You can totally tell, like, Tolkien was right in the first Lord of the Rings book. I was like, how about a guy who didn't give a fuck about any of this shit? Like, let's do, like, an interminable chapter about it. But I always appreciated that. I always appreciated a kind of look outwards rather than being so self-obsessed. But yeah, that moment blew my mind. There should have been more of those moments.
The rendering in this game is amazing. His face is amazing.
Like, oh, fuck his face. What about the back of his head and the neck rolls?
The neck rolls, the lats, and the shoulders, all of it, yeah.
Someone has sweated day and night over getting those rolls in his neck to look as good as they do.
But you can see every sort of pore of suffering in his cheeks, and every little sort of, like, his beard is even sorry to even be growing on his face.
It really is.
It's eats a out bit by bit.
I was playing it, I was streaming it through my PlayStation onto my Steam Deck for a fair bit of it. Every single time I put it on the actual big telly, like, it doesn't matter what he was doing, just like staring at a wall or something. When that turned on, it took my breath away with how beautiful.
It's amazing.
It's so good looking. On PlayStation 5, I don't know how it is on PC, but on PS5, it just looks glorious. Like, even when people aren't doing anything, like, literally just, again, those skin folds. Ooh, mama.
And the vistas as well. There's some amazing, like, the environment art in this game is near peerless. Like, the views across Asgard, which are just like, I could really just sit here for a long time.
Even that
my
stupid
lunch watching this.
Even that stupid loading screen world tree is still pretty nice. You have to run around and have a chat while you're waiting for the next area to stream.
Oh yeah.
But
and you get to meet. Sorry, Jamie.
No, please go on.
You get to meet the world serpent again, which for me was, like, the biggest kind of meeting, making me, like, in a Wordsworth sense, feel like an infinitesimal speck of nothing against, a mountainside moment, was actually, like, meeting the world serpent when he came up and he speaks to you in this, like, crunching horrendous sound. I had headphones on when I was watching it, and the pads were rumbling, but I wasn't thinking about any of that, because it's like, oh my god, a god is speaking to me directly in my face, that I could feel spittle and what it's saying is basically just go away. It's basically what it always tells you. But
Atreus,
you know,
is like, can I have some plot?
And he's like, no.
No.
Yeah, it's weird.
Bloodworm does not speak for you.
That is like one of five major plot moments spread out across the 30 hours where Atreus is in search of an answer and gets none.
Fuck off, Atreus.
I will be more positive about the game eventually, but like, just to harp on a little bit more about its purposelessness, like, I feel like that's mirrored to some extent in the choices they've made about the mechanics and the structure of the game. Like, it's very linear for the first 15 hours of the game. And like, I think God of War 1 also was quite linear, but it does open up. And but like this... there's very little choice over to where to go in this game. So there are no areas with like differently ranked enemies that you need to upgrade yourself to do battle with. And yet the game is absolutely stacked with the kinds of upgrades and XP and customization that would be required if you did have that choice. Yeah. And it's just sort of like annoying that there's so much UI faff for like tens of hours, which amount to nothing, because every combat has to be designed for you to beat it, regardless of what you do in the menus. And so it all feels very unnecessary. And like in 15 hours, I encountered one enemy, who I thought, I will come back to him later when I've upgraded a bit. And I probably could have spanked him anyway if I tried it for a third time. The fact that you need to upgrade then ties you into like its exploratory systems. Like, it, in order to get all the kind of trinkets to upgrade, you need to explore the environments fully to find all the treasure in them. And the characters have some good jokes about this. Like, Atreus is telling another god, oh yeah, my dad just loves loot. It's like, why are you going over there? Oh, a treasure chest. Okay, yeah. Got it.
It's like, he does that sometimes.
Yeah. But like, in every case, for the first 15 hours or so, exploration just means looking in a side room and seeing that there's a chest there. Like, it's really easy to miss, but it's boring to find, which seems like an odd odd part of the Venn diagram to choose. And there's some puzzles to reach, some chests.
Yeah.
The puzzles in the game suck ass, man. They're like genuinely bad. Like, some of them prescriptive in ways that don't make sense. There's stuff like, you need to freeze a channel of water with your axe, but if you throw your axe into the water, it doesn't work. You have to throw it into the wooden side of the channel in this one spot. Yeah. And I spent a lot of time on those puzzles where, you know, I'd gain a false impression of what the mechanics were by a false positive, and then just be confounded when I actually found the actual answer was something I would have tried, but the game was telling me that wouldn't work in some way. There's a thing where you have to freeze a channel, then you roll down some explosive boulders into it. And I thought, oh, okay, so it must be something to do with exploding the boulders, because they're explosive boulders and you're told they explode. But no, what you have to do is remove your axe, and because the rocks are cold, they stop moving, which is not a thing I think cold rocks tend to observe. But it just, a lot of them just don't make any sense. And
it is a bit tricky with the puzzles. There's a lot of it, like a lot of it in what I played, even on the critical path, like not just getting after side stuff, there's a lot of axe throwing you have to do. It's a stag weekend vibes. You know, it's a bit weird being, as you know, the personification of the idea of war. And what do you do as the personification of war? Well, I cleave flesh from mortal bodies with my magical axe, and like, what else? It's like, I solve puzzles which involve throwing my magic axe at things and then catching them in such a way that causes them to go through two strings at once. Like, oh, okay, right. That's badass.
I'm really into watermills. Like, oh, okay. That's an interesting hobby, I suppose.
If you've got a channel what needs freezing, come to me and I'll do it.
Yeah, there's some really awkward mechanics around arrows and their various effects, sort of status effects they can have. And these are tied into the puzzles. So, like, some of them, you can shoot them at the wall and they'll put, like, a sort of, you know, an area of effect, a glowing area of effect, and then you could chain them together and then shoot the last one and they'll explode in chain and then pop a lock or something.
Those ones really fucked me off. That's the one that was like right before I put the pad down. Like, what do you want me to do? You want me to put some glowing orbs across this lake? They'll stick to some things, but not others. And then you need me to blow up one of them, and that will chain across the lake and burn down these thorns. Like, oh man, do I have to do this? Like, it's hurting my head. It's like, I really was just enjoying splitting elves open with an axe like they were insects. Like,
it's frustrating because like some of the side quests are really good. So there's one where there's if you follow one track, you're gradually freeing a huge beast from a lake by going around the lake and doing a series of quests around, which reward you with those chests and with those silly puzzles. But eventually there is a great story moment, and you and Atreus have a great moment with this giant creature. However, there's no way to tell when you're about to invest this time when you're going to get one of those, or when you're going to get one of the kind of like the loot tombola game, where you sort of like spits out a piece of chest armor that gives you a sort of it doesn't even give you a percentage chance. It will just say a small chance of improving runic damage for 5 seconds, and that's the nature of most of the kind of average loot that you pick up. And unfortunately, like if you just say a small percentage chance of an effect happening, it means absolutely nothing. Like, I think they might have been trying to avoid putting too many numbers and sort of like, overcomplicating it. But actually, what does, if you tell me that there's a small effect of something happening, I'm not going to bother with it. Yeah. there's much more to be doing in the game. So, what's the difference between tiny number, and small?
Small number, like character RPG, where you add +3 to ice or whatever, +3% chance to blah blah blah. They should just kill those dead from games. They're always rubbish. It's never like big numbers good. Like +50% chance to explode into all ice and shit. Sign me up.
It should be abilities. Like all that I think players care about, particularly the game about like just whacking things relentlessly, is like, oh, what new way do I get to whack a thing with? Is basically like, I don't really care about having a sort of frost shield appear around me 3% chance of the time every time I strike. I really, really don't care. What I really like about the game is that some of the combat moves are some of the most satisfying moves in third person action combat that I've experienced in any game. So for example, when you throw your axe, when you recoil it, there's a way to recoil it where Kratos will jump up in the air, catch it, and then strike down and do a massive area of effect attack. And that is one of, like, I did that. I must have done that 1,000 times. It was in the first game, it was in the second game, and I was like, look, you got me. This is just amazing. And he's got his chains, and there's some really good stuff you could do with, like, juggling people and stuff like that.
There's a weapon later in the game, but I don't think I can spoil what it is. But it's one of the best weapons in any game played. It's so good. It's a brilliant idea as well, and it works. Oh, it's just,
And it's so different. Like, it's markedly different from everything else. So it's a... before having this discussion, I started a new game plus, just, and you get that from the start. So, and it's so good because you've got all your upgrades and you've got that third weapon, and I just rocked that third weapon for the entire game, as far as my replay was. But the combat, I think, like, we've talked a lot about the plot and the story and stuff, because that's why it's been so lauded, I think. Like, most of all, I went back and read loads of the reviews before we had this chat. And very few of them actually really get into the combat, but that is what you're doing all the time. Like, really, like that's what it's about. It's about knocking enemies down until they get stunned, and then doing execution moves, and then activating your rage to catch fire, regain health. There are very different versions of that where you can charge people and just do loads of damage. And you've got these three really distinct weapon sets that you can upgrade. And actually, if you do want to get stuck into this kind of like the gear stuff, they can really buff a lot of the powers that you have, a lot of the kind of special moves that you have in each weapon set, if you prefer one. And there's a lot there, actually. And that's what, like, even the first game, after the kind of main story ended, you could still fight the Valkyries. There were still kind of like really high level things that you could go and do that I did most of them until I was satisfied. And that all of that kind of meaty, fun combat stuff is still in this game. And it's still it is still fun all the time.
Oh yeah, and there's like tens and tens of hours of it left after you finish the game. In fact, like I think one of the flaws of its structure is that and the fact that it delays giving you gratification in so many ways is that by the time that it opens up and there are all of these actually quite interesting side quests available to you, I was just done. I wanted to do it. I'd power on through to the end. And you even have your side characters are nagging you all the time. They're like, you know, we could stick around in Midgard and do the odd mission, brother. And you're like, shut the fuck up. I need to be this to be over now.
Well, it's funny that like on one of those side missions early on, like I think you alluded to it, Marsh, where like Atreus is going like, why are you hanging out with me, Dad? Why are we doing this side content? There's like proper stuff to be doing. And what's the head lad called? Is that Mermir? He eventually says, like, have you ever considered that he just wants to spend time with your lad? Like, yeah. And that's like a lovely moment, but it also tells me that the developers are also feeling that and also worrying about that moment. I mean, it's fucking good value for money, right? I mean, 70 quid if you buy it proper, or I'm just looking at my box from CEX, 38 quid from CEX. It's expensive. Games are expensive. I feel like I always talk about money on this podcast, but I feel like it's very important because like games are so pricey. 70 quid is very pricey. God of War is one of the first games I've played that goes for 70 quid that like feels like good value for money for that amount of...
I think you might get 70 hours out of it, honestly, if you try to do all the side content. You might get so much of it.
And there's so much of it. It's got that roguelike mode. I don't know if any of us have tried that yet.
No, I didn't bother. It's Valhalla, right?
It's called Valhalla, yeah. It might be worth a wee go to see if there's something interesting going on there. I've read good reviews of it. But like, it feels like they really didn't want people to feel out of pocket for this game. And you don't. There's no way you could. It's too huge. There's too much content. There's too much time and effort put into the content that's there. I do think that like... you know, in the AAA gaming space, the idea of like what a valuable experience is still emerging. I think this is a fair go at it. But like, if you want players to be able to play a game that will last for quite a long time, but with like high level cinematic quality and graphics and all that sort of stuff, like I think it is a really hard task to pull off well. I can't think of that many games. Marvel's Spider-Man is the one that comes to mind, but I can't think of many others that in the current generation have been able to tell a story which feels concrete and malleable at the same time. that feel like a, you know, a real experience that is value for money, but also doesn't last just like 10 hours or something like that. So I think Ragnarok is a fair shot at doing it. And for a lot of people, it's obviously the kind of apotheosis of that form. But it's interesting to see how people come at it from different angles. And I think this is a fair take on the job of it, on the mission of AAA in the 2020s.
I would say that I think this is one of the few games where I would recommend that people play the first game before going to the second, because presumably the first game might be able to get a hold of it for much cheaper. It's still absolutely excellent, but I think it's a sort of better paced and better formed game than even the second. But if you find that you love the characters and you love the story that was set up in the first game, that will carry you through the second. So I think that's just a gold recommendation.
Yeah, and just so much talent on display. It feels weirdly harsh to slag it off on the game like this that is so beautiful. And obviously, there's nothing about it that's insincere in the slightest. You know, that would be a real, you know, if it felt like they were just trying to, you know, close this franchise down so they could make something else. But there's none of that. There is just a deep sincerity, which is probably to the game's ultimate detriment. But still, it's hard to condemn. And it, you know, it's funny, there's a bit where Atreus tries to smash a chest like Kratos does and hurts his hand. It's really good. There's a talking squirrel, I guess that's a spoiler, but there's a like hilarious like Disney talking squirrel that rocks up at one point, which I reliably informed is part of Norse mythology, which is kind of hilarious. So yeah, I think I think we've probably talked about it enough. But yeah, it's a good game. It's just a bit too long, and they need an inciting incident in the first 5 hours rather than at some point. I mean, where I got to in the game, it hadn't happened yet. So
I do wonder, actually. It feels like a game that was supposed to be two games, given the road to Ragnarok and the relationship between Atreus and Kratos. So I wonder, what is going to happen. Oh, this series is not going to die because they've done incredibly well these games, it seems. So it's got to go somewhere next. So might leave that to our listeners and people in the Discord to speculate. And it feels as though they have to move on. To me, it feels as though Kratos needs to move on to a different mythology and then regrets the previous mythology as he
but
did.
But the
this
problem
one.
Is, the problem is that there is a. I don't know how far the original games went down this line, but going and killing the pantheon of each different belief system, right, is cool, right? And I guess he did it with the Greek gods and maybe some Roman gods. I don't know what he did in those games, right? But there's an interesting reboot you do of God of War, right? Where he goes to he goes and kills all the Hindu gods. Now, maybe this would be problematic. I don't know.
I mean, you get into trouble quite quickly, I think. Yeah, if you
probably would. So maybe not that. But still, I would also enjoy watching him tear the arms off Shiva one by one.
Oh my God.
Sorry.
Look, I mean, it's probably happened before in video games somewhere, not in this series, I don't think I've seen, but yeah.
I mean, I taught myself out of the idea as I was explaining.
That's what I mean, it's quite difficult.
Self-cancelled.
I cancelled myself there. I can see why they went with ancient religions that aren't practiced anymore for him to murder his way through, rather than hitting for ones that people still...
Yeah, I feel as though the next step is probably just to go for God of War 1-1, where it actually goes right back to the start of Greek mythology all over again, but he still remembers everything he did the first time and the second time and the rest of it. And we end up in this miserable, endless slaughter.
I'd quite like to see him fight Jesus. That would be quite good.
Take on the 12 disciples who are all characterized like Russian gangsters or something like that. Oh, I don't know what kind of modern spin they put on it.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of 50-50 on the depiction of the Norse gods as a gangster family in this one, I've got to say.
I like the fact that they talk in such a unapologetic modern idiom. I've endured so many years of Norse mythology and Roman mythology being depicted solely by British character actors dispensing with the ye olde speak and just going straight for common parlance of a very unapologetically American kind, I thought was really quite refreshing. I don't mind it at all.
It doesn't fall into that trap. I can't remember which of you guys I was talking to about, but when you have British, when you use British as the default old timey language, you run the risk of doing that. I always call it would you acting or writing, where they're going, what would you have me do? Would you have me do this? Well, I would have you do that. Well, what would you have me do if you would? Would you have me be a clown? You know, that sort of stuff. The word would is at every writer's fingertips when they're trying to write old timey. And there's almost none of that in this game. Which is what happens when you use Americans.
Yeah, the Norse gods crew that they do talk to each other that they are a dysfunctional family, I suppose. I did genuinely feel sorry for Thor. I just felt like he was just a very put down guy who was just kind of miserable about his circumstance and was been relentlessly berated by Odin. You get to hang out with him in various points. I think it's he doesn't have to be who he was in, the editors and stuff. He's the most impetuous and active character in any story that he's involved in. And in this, for him rendering him completely passive is kind of a bit of a microcosm of what the game does to all of its characters, I think.
Yeah.
I like that he's fat.
Oh, yeah. No, sorry, Mushko.
No, go for it.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, he's absolutely the guy in the pub who would mess everyone up. And that's, a very good Norse god image, I think.
Yeah, well, it flips that on its head by giving him a drinking problem and having other characters angst about that in a way which was maybe a step too modern for me.
I didn't like also, that at all.
There's also a moment in which...
My name's Four, I'm an alcoholic. Hi, Four.
One character says to another, I appreciate you. I was like, oh, no, come on.
Yeah,
like it's a tender moment, and like I understand what they were trying to achieve, but there's just something about using the language of very online therapy speak that rang really wrong for me. But
I also really did not like that, and also Thor like he gets drunk when he wants to, and then just dissolves it. Like he just goes and does what he wants. Like he's a I just felt like I felt a bit let down because I was so desperate for someone to do something in the game, like something, you know, to actually strike out and change the, you know, the landscape. And, you know, the fight between Thor and Kratos creates this giant frozen lightning strike in the middle of a huge open world area that you drive around. But for the rest of it, Thor is just kind of very sad. And
yeah. Just doing fetch quests for his dad.
Doing fetch quests for his dad, and he's mollified. And I guess that's, he's under this emotional cosh. But if there's anyone who's going to break out of that mold and do something, it's either Kratos or him. and it's just like nothing happens. Everything just.
I do like the bit in the fight with him where you get hit in the back of the head by his hammer. Which is your trick that you use against people constantly, and then he uses it against you, which is quite funny. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, I enjoyed it feels as though there should have been like 3 or 4 fights between them that just sort of escalate to increasingly stupid levels.
Early on he kills you and then restarts your heart with lightning so he can beat you up more. That's pretty good.
Yeah, that's fantastic. That's absolutely fantastic.
But it's like that's like a parallel of Baldur's appearance in the first game where he you spank each other and then he gets up and he's absolutely fine and he's like, I'm going to fuck you up later. I'll be back. And in this one, like Thor fucks you up and then he's like, that's it. Goodbye. And then you don't see him for the rest of the game. It's just like,
good. Anyway, well.
It was fun. I enjoyed it.
Yes, it's okay.
I think we've all come to terms with our violent pasts, and can now live happy lives doing fuck knows. I guess going back and finishing our unfinished side quests.
Kill all the Valkyries in the first game. That's fun.
Fucking Valkyries. It's gonna suck.
Did you want to talk about another game or move on to questions from questions?
I would like to hear Tom talk about Monster Hunter. Monster Hunter Beef. I don't know what it's called. Monster Hunter.
It's called Monster Hunter Wilds. There was an open beta this weekend across consoles and PC. And to be clear, before I start being very positive about this, I played on PS5 where everything, just from my perspective, seemed to be completely fine. People who were playing on PC and, you know, various different territories were experiencing, like, they were going into the game and the big monsters were just horrendous polygonal just kind of constructs with faces smeared across them in deeply disturbing ways. And then they would sort of fly up and down according to the game logic of where the core of the original beast might have been, but it was nonetheless the kind of like horrible polygonal mess. It was a bit like, you know, Event Horizon, where all the logic had gone from the game and no one could actually play it anymore. And everyone left it feeling disturbed and then posted it all on Reddit and Twitter. So that was kind of like, that's the kind of, the overall kind of impression of the Monster Hunter Wilds beta that's come out of it. But I've got to say, I've got to communicate how flippin' good it was when I played this game on Sunday. I'd like parked away all my chores and stuff. I thought, I've got like an hour and a half, then I've got to do the shopping. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go into the Monster Hunter Wild beta. I made my cat in the game. His name is Cheddar. designer myth that has got actually a genuinely incredible character creator, like really, really good. So I decided
for humans or cats?
character. What do you mean?
Well, you designed. Did you say you designed your cat first?
Oh yes, yeah. So you design yourself, and then you design your cat fellow, and you hang out together throughout the entire game. So I designed my cat, and then my partner Emma was in there, and he was like, "No, that's not right." And she made sure that Cheddar was correct, so we got him right. And then I made sure that my character was obviously a dark bearded Adonis. For my character, and she's like, "That's not right." And I said, "Oh yeah, I'll change it." And then she went out, and then I didn't change it. I rolled out, and you hop onto the back of this sort of velociraptor, but like an actual what a velociraptor might have looked like, as in a feathered lizard with four arms and stuff in it, and you're bounding across this open desert, and your first hunt is this giant kind of like bear thing. So you hop out in front of this bear thing, and I played a bunch of Monster Hunter games before, and they are like quite sort of technical and quite like stodgy and weird and like hard to get into, and I was expecting a lot of that going into this. But what happened was I attacked the bear, and then I was chopping at the bear with my big giant longsword. I knew all the move sets from previous games, blah, 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 but actually it's quite easy to pick up. And then, like, my cat, who I carefully designed, went meow. And then the subtitle popped up at the bottom. Oh, my whiskers are tingling. The weather's about to change. I was like, oh, thanks. I guess that might be useful. And then so I kept slashing, rolling, slashing, powering up the blade. It glows red. I'm sort of trying to get the critical hits on its head. This is the sort of thing you do in Monster Hunter. And then it goes, my cat is just like, doesn't shut up, like my actual cat. And it's just like, ah! I was like, actually what? And then suddenly I'm fighting this bear in the middle of this desert, and a sandstorm blows across, and like you can't see more than maybe like in game terms 5 meters in front of you. I could sort of see the sort of nose and the sort of shadow of the thing I'm trying to fight. And then like that happens. I was like, okay, well, this is the storm. It's a sort of a visibility thing. You know, maybe there's ways to kind of like get through this. But then actually like 3 or 4 seconds later, everything goes dark. Like day turns to night, and suddenly there is lightning striking a giant, like, huge mountainous structure in the distance, and illuminating the entire environment with every lightning strike in bright blue through the sand. And I was like, am I having a stroke? Like, what is actually happening? And the bear is going ape, and I'm just like... It's just like I was like swatting at it with my giant longsword, but it's just an incredible change of scenery and like stuff rushing around me. The sound is incredible. The headphones on, and then like I'm just fighting it. My cat's also going mad and going meow, and then I'm just throwing like curatives at me, which are they're called vigor wasps in Monster Hunter. They're sort of like bugs that are attached to kind of like globules of healing energy that and your little power will throw them at you. And I was like, thank you, because I don't know what the hell else. It's the only thing I've got to hold on to is my healing cats while I'm fighting this bear in this kind of crazy midnight storm. And I don't know what it means. I don't know what the storm means. Like, if you're gonna put this in the game and sort of like make and change the entire environment around you and turn night like into day and day into night in an instant, there must be something to it. So but I'm still slashing away, the ape's going, and then there's sort of and then the lightning wyvern turns up, and
oh my goodness,
and it's hovering above it. It's like, and it shows up, it's like, okay, I didn't think that was in the beta. I didn't think that was in the short demo version of the game. And it sort of starts fighting the bear that I am fighting, And to be clear, this is a mechanic that was in Monster Hunter World before. Yeah. This is a mechanic that has been in the game for a few times, where monsters will fight each other, and some will come out on top more than others. And you can take advantage of them by, like, you can back off, you sharpen your weapon, you have your curatives, you're looking around and you're saying, okay, well, it seems as though the apocalypse is actually happening, so I'll take the anti-apocalypse drug as far as I can find that on my little menu of sort of, you know, things to glug, like anti-lightning, there's lots of lightning happening. And then, so I just watch them fight each other, and then the bear takes loads of damage, but fights the wyvern off. The wyvern flies off, and I see other players running after the wyvern, and I realize that I'm not even hunting that thing. That was some other players hunting that thing that came here to do this to the guy I was hunting. And this incredible interaction happens. And then my mind was blowing, because I was like, this is the most video games thing that's happened in a video game to me, like, for ages. I can't remember the last time something so exciting happened, where I just went into this horrible fight with this thing. Everything changes. Wyvern comes in, goes out. Other players come across my view. They didn't help me at all. That was fine, because
it's still video games.
It's still video games. They had, you know, they were min-maxing, and they obviously had great builds and stuff. And I was just like, you know, just trying to trash a bear. And then suddenly, you know, eventually the storm calms down. The wyvern's gone. And then you get back into the Monster Hunter rhythm, where you whittle down the monster, and then it gets really sad, and then it limps back to its lair, and then you murder it, and then you take its skin, and then you turn that into armor, which is actually what the game is really all about. That is the core kind of, you know, loot arc that you go through, like every between like 30 minutes, 50 minutes per session in this game. This has been the case since, like, for many, many editions of Monster Hunter. But I just thought the execution and the generational leap in presentation and the excitement and the incredible animation work that has gone into the monsters. Monsters have always been super well animated and really, really kind of full of personality. There are ones that you feel sorry for. There are ones that you just hate because they're, you know, actual, like, just totally irredeemable bastards, and you just can't you just have to skin them and then wear them and I just kind of saw the potential for Monster Hunter Worlds just to be the best game of next year. We're talking earlier about, like, if you're actually going to try and get into something, Monster Hunter games are always, like, very, very deep, and they are always well expanded, and it's building on, like, a really, really good base of, like, weapon types, weapon sets, and styles of play. And it's really, and it's completely built around co-op, and has been for many years. And I just think it's gonna be one of the biggest games the next sort of 2-3 years. Like, honestly, like, because if it just repeats that formula, as long as it gets stable, and as long as it fixes the performance stuff that's happened on other consoles and PCs and all the technical stuff, if it gets past all that, I mean, it was unbelievable. Like,
it's coming out at the end of February next year, so it feels like they've done it relatively early to catch at least a bunch of those.
Yeah, and I'd hope they'd run another one before it actually launches, to be honest, based on how bad a lot of the stuff was on PC. There's definitely room to sort of hold off and watch it and see how the launch goes next year if you're interested in this game. But I would say that if you've not played Monster Hunter before, this is going to be one of the more accessible ones. But that it's worth dipping into a demo
to neg you, because I love you as a brother, but that is what Monster Hunter people say every time a Monster Hunter game comes out.
I know. Yeah.
They say this is the one that's really accessible and you can get on board with it. And I always try. And there's always a moment about 3 or 4 hours in where I'm like, there's just too much going on. Like, there is so much happening in this game.
That's completely reasonable. It's honestly the controls, because for me, I think it's the controls, because each weapon controls really differently in terms of like the actual how you actually deal damage and like just the spacing you need between the monster, predicting the monster's movements. And while you can lock on is not actually how you play the game. Like you've got this huge thing that's way bigger than you that you need to back off and then time your strikes in particular ways. It's very unusual rhythm, and it's a very acquired kind of to actually get that satisfying big massive head smash with
a huge hammer
is difficult.
I'm wondering, I really enjoyed Dragon's Dogma 2 this year, and I'm wondering if, because I think that has a similar kind of design in how the combat works on that, so I'm wondering if having played that and enjoyed that, that will unlock somewhat so the same engine as well, and I think a bunch of the same people, so might be
That's a good shout, actually, because there are similar mechanics. So in Dragon's Dogma 2, which I'm near the end of, I think, you have a bunch of, they're called pawns, that are basically AI co-partners who help you, and you get to hire them from an ether of other sort of player-created pawns. So you pick them, and then they fill out your squad, and then you go on a fight with them. And they're all idiots, and they fall off bridges, and do all that stupid stuff. So it's sort of like some really sloppy implementation of this idea. But in the new Monster Hunter, you could do something where you shoot up a flare. It's called, and what that does is that it advertises your hunt for other hunters to jump in. But if no other hunters want to join your flare, it will fill out your party with AI, which is a big difference, because it's particularly like 3DS when I was playing Monster Hunter, there's just no one else around, so you've got to solo the whole thing. So it feels as though it is probably like it's a good thing to make the game more accessible for just like casual pub pickup games. However, the game is still quite complicated for just a casual pub pickup game, so there is that there. I think there's a bit of friction there.
Awesome. Well, sounds good. Shall we do some questions from questions?
Sure.
Yeah.
The questions from questions Discord channel is going great guns, by the way. If you haven't checked it out yet, it's really fun. Like the questions that we go through, you know, it means we can, like, if we haven't come to your question yet, we probably will, because there's loads of really good ones in there. And also there's just really great chat after every question that comes up. So get involved. This question is from Dig. Under night in birth exe colon late open square brackets ST close square brackets sound like it would appear with many adult orientated tags on its Steam page, but is actually a great fighting game developed by the oddly named Soft Circle French Bread, who also make the almost as preposterously named Melty Blood series. What's a game you very much enjoy but think has a terrible name? Anyone want to go first on this one?
Yeah, I've been actually playing a game called Caravan Sandwich recently, which is
amazing.
Fantastic.
What was the name of that? Was it French? What was it? French Bread? What was the name of the developer?
They're called Soft Circle colon French Bread.
Right, yeah. Caravan Sandwich feels like it's in the same ballpark. Yeah. But also, it is made by French developers, so maybe this is...
Absolutely.
Maybe that's the point of commonality. But it's actually not even sandwich. It's sand witch, as in a witch who lives in the sand. But it's still... you know, one word. So they're obviously playing on, I don't know what they're playing on, but the thing is, it's a great game. It's a game about, it's, in fact, it's quite a lot like, it reminds me of like Sable or Citizen Sleeper, where it's this quite kind of beautiful and winsome and slightly melancholic game about living on a rapidly abandoned colony planet. Just like, not abandoned for any like, aliens are here reasons, but like abandoned because the big capitalist organization that had colonized it has just lost interest, basically. And they're going off and like building a Dyson thing around the sun, which will eventually probably extinguish life on the planet. But you and like there's a colony of hippies still there, basically, eking out this life and salvaging electronics from these, you know, the detritus left behind by this corporation. And it's beautiful. It looks like some of it looks like Brittany in France, and some of it's desert. And but it's just it's quite poorly translated, so that's a bit of a struggle. But like the vibe of it is absolutely gorgeous, and the it needed another 6 months in development, I would say, because there's a bunch of things which don't quite work about it, which feel like, you know, they should. But I really recommend it. Caravan Sandwich, terrible name. Good game.
Sounds good. Yeah, I saw that made a bit of a splash when it released last month. And
it did. Okay, I assumed it had gone down without a trace because I hadn't ever heard of it. Really,
I think sadly it did sort of go down without a trace, but it made a splash on significant people on social media that I follow.
I see.
I don't think it. Yeah, I mean it's a tricky sell, that kind of thing. But yeah, I need to play that one. I'm gonna turn this question on its head and say that I think that the Chinese Room should just be lauded for having all of the best names for all of their games. Like, and they do so much better than everyone else. So their games are Dear Esther, Amnesia, : A Machine for Pigs, Everyone's Gone to the Rapture, Little Orpheus, not so good, Still Wakes the Deep, and then another game made by one of their devs called The Magnificent Truffle Pigs. And I just think they have just got the best titling game in town, and I don't think they get enough plaudits for it. I don't think I've spoken about Still Wakes the Deep. I will probably try and chat about it at some point on this podcast, because maybe I'll replay it and talk about it, because it's maybe my favorite game of the year. I loved it to absolute bits.
Maybe I'll play it. It's going to be too scary for me, though, I think.
It's not that scary. Actually, I think there's a version of it which tones down the jump scares a little bit. I can't quite remember. Oh, really? But yeah, it's a wonderful game. I fucking love a horror walking sim kind of thing. You know, that game is just great. Yeah, if you guys or any assortment of crowbar heads want to replay that game, then I will happily do it along with you, because yeah, I thought it was wonderful. Chinese Room, excellent naming game. There's a lot of like JRPG games which I haven't played, but I'm kind of fascinated by their titles. So there's Bravely Default, Unicorn Overlord, Metaphor e Fantasio, Live Alive, Octopath Traveler. And I realized in putting those names together that almost all of them are from the same people. It's Team Asano, who make all of those games. And just someone, I was sort of looking about them on Reddit, and someone said it's almost like their defining characteristic as a team is to announce the working title of their game and then just keep that as the actual title of the game when it releases, which I think is true. But I don't actually think those are bad titles, really. I mean, they are bad titles, but I generally think that a bad title just kind of keeps things interesting, really. Like, whatever the kind of translation of it is from Japanese or how it's translated, I'm ignorant to how that works, but like, it doesn't matter. Like, a game called Metaphor Refantasio is just makes the world more interesting, I think. So I will never condemn a game for having a bad name. I mean, Resident Evil is a fucking stupid name if you think about it. Like, it's not a cool name. It's only cool because of the games that have been subsequently released under it, I think.
There are definitely, you've got to make it Googleable or, you know, findable in some way if you're picking a game name for sure. Like, you can't just call it like water and then hope that.
Yeah, I was talking to my boss, the creative director at my company, and I was maligning the amount of games with, you know, Brink War or, you know, War Nexus type things in there, you know, all the kind of video gamey words. And he was just pointing out that, like, you have to come up with a silly word because then you can copyright it. And I know that IP. So that's why you get so many nexuses and all that kind of flim flam around, because it means that you're strengthening your IP, which I guess is true.
No, that really is true. But I'm not sure it that excuses Under Night in Birth XE : late open square brackets ST close square brackets. That just seems like it's going. I don't know what's that serving. Who's that serving? as an answer, I've got to say, actually, like you mentioned, Refantasio. So what's it called precisely? It's called Metaphor : Refantasio. this is a game that's actually really worth paying attention to. And there was a demo that I played like last month. It's worth checking if it's still up. I'm not sure if it is, but it's from the same developers who created the Persona series, the recent Persona games, particularly like, and it's mapped onto the same pattern as in terms of progression and, you know, mechanics, in terms of social mechanics, as Persona 5. So it's a fantasy world where you wander in and you've got a little book that, you know, that actually describes the world that we live in, but they live in a world where there are lots of different, lots of different races, and they all hate each other, and they want to live in our world where everything's brilliant. And so there's this sort of like really tawdry and tedious dramatic irony to that, except that they do have the Persona 5 thing of people that you meet become in the Persona series, they become Personas that give you extra powers and extra conversation options. They boost your personal social stats. And there's a whole social RPG attached to a typical fantasy sword and board adventure in ReFantasia, which is very good. I really like that format.
From Kane, the almighty Kane. I recently watched the Satisfactory announcement trailer from 2018, and it's a good and appealing trailer, but also remarkable to see just how completely the 1.0 release delivered on what that trailer promised 6 years ago. Watching it, you realise it could have been recorded from the release game. Seeing it again has prompted me to ask, what are the best trailers of all time? And he goes on to mention the trailer for Control, which is, as he mentions, is a just shots from the game where they've taken the UI off with some excellent VO, and also the ones for the Satisfactory. Yeah, I think this is an interesting question because like the game trailers are obviously such a huge part of the industry, and they're kind of central to pretty much every single game's like marketing and release and all that sort of stuff. Like, but actually to find like genuinely good examples of it, I think is quite tricky. Like, the one that came to mind from recently was the trailer for Tears of the Kingdom, which was just a completely spectacular trailer, not least because of the music, which was just a really like outlandishly sumptuous version of the main Zelda theme with like saxophones in it and all these like weird blurpy bleepy sound effects all over the top of it. It was kind of weird and excessive and beautiful, and it was just really, really, you know, they don't use that piece of music in the games in the Breath of the Wild game, so it was just fantastic to hear it overlaid with just so much like bombast. And another one that springs to mind was the trailer for, I believe the game was called, I just had to Google it, Jet, the Far Shore, which was like a weirdo kind of spacey game made by the people who did Super Brothers, that game, Sword and Sorcery EP, that game, which was just a really weird tone poem with some space stuff in it. And I think when the game came out, it didn't do too well, and people were kind of quite confused by the kind of final result of it. But that trailer was just like something from another universe, you know, just completely strange and wonderful, and didn't describe the game that they were making whatsoever, but completely like put that game in my head as something genuinely unusual. I think they are real masters of the use of music in their games, and I think that kind of really showed that off. So those were a couple that sprung to my head, as well as the Elden Ring full blown gameplay trailer. But I think that was just because we were waiting for it for so long, and like, you know, Jeff Keighley, whatever you think about him, it was quite powerful seeing him like choked up getting ready to announce it and how excited he was. Like, I felt that.
Is
excited.
Jeff Keighley capable of?
He got choked up. He was sad about
did
it.
Did he?
Yeah. Well, I mean, people have been shouting at him on the internet for about 3 years about not showing any Elden Ring footage. So when he eventually did, I guess
it's not his fault. He doesn't
mostly with relief.
Work for From Software.
But I was watching that along with people on the Souls forum on our Discord, and that was just
that's cool.
Fucking hell, this is going to be the best game ever.
But yeah, it's hard to separate what makes a good trailer from your natural hype for the game itself. But
yeah,
I would suggest a little known indie game, Grand Theft Auto 4.
What? That's really good. Yeah,
that the first trailer for that is absolutely astonishing, because I don't think anybody was expecting anything quite like it. It's got this the Philip Glass. Koyaanisqatsi.
It's not that bit of it, but they should have used it.
No.
it's the Yeah.
Exactly. And it's time lapse. And you see, so, I mean, it's demonstrating the living city, basically, and saying this is every bit as important and majestic as the natural world and the human world as depicted by Philip Glass. And then it cuts to Niko Bellic saying, you know, I've come from a place of war, maybe things will be different here. And you're like, oh, holy shit, this has got a character from Eastern Europe as the protagonist.
Right.
And it's setting like a completely alien tone for that series, which had been, you know, frivolous bombast up until that point, essentially.
And to which they would return. I mean,
But like, where just it made such an amazing statement that, and also demonstrated the technical nous of the game as well. It's a real achievement to marry those two things.
I definitely wasn't cool enough to have heard of Koyaanisqatsi and the accompanying movie that they were drawing on when that trailer was released. I imagine, Marsh, you were way ahead of it at the time, but I was completely not.
I don't know, but I think it communicates that gravitas without you even knowing the origin of that stuff, you know.
Fantastic. What a trailer. Yeah, really good.
Yeah, that's a really good shout. One I'd mention, which I think we've probably mentioned before on the podcast, is the original Supreme Commander trailer, which is like the actual kind of announcement trailer, which shows you pretty much the entire game. And what it does is it starts out with like a few units fighting, then it zooms out a bit to what a normal RTS at the time, you know, what you'd expect for that. And then it zooms back out to, you know, probably like 10 times the number of units that you'd expect. And then you're like, whoa, this is crazy. And then it zooms out again. And then it's like 100 times the things that you were expecting to ever appear on a screen in an RTS game. And then there were flipping robots crawling out of the ocean and then attacking things with lasers. And then there's a fantastic escalation that was not a lie. That is exactly what happens. You can make all of those units in the game, those conflicts, that map that they filmed that on is in the game. It wasn't a fantasy. Like, it was a true representation of what was to come. And that's one of the things, one of the reasons that I think PC Gamer jumped on it, and I loved it, particularly like even before I worked for PC Gamer, because I was just like, wow, this is what PCs could do at this time. We could make realize this crazy kind of robot war on this insane scale that we've never seen before.
Clarkson to be seen in this particular robot war.
Absolutely. Yeah, you've got to be careful not to stray into the Clarkson territory. And again, the original reveal of, I mentioned Persona earlier, but like Persona 5, the opening trailer for that is really, really cool, because it goes, opens in the first sort of third with the typical, it's a little pre-baked kind of well-animated anime stuff. And then it actually dips into classroom scenes and like dramatic cuts between classroom here and then sports scenes in the yard. And it's like, yeah, this is actually what Persona is about. It's about having, you know, gaining points from throwing three pointers in a particular social interaction, and I think it's really good and also representative of the game, like as a whole.
I'm also going to throw in, and I'll put this in the show notes. I'll put all these trailers in the show notes if I can be asked. But I'll definitely put in the trailer. It's not even the trailer; it's just the advert that was shown on TV. I'm just checking the date. Yeah, this would be the very early 90s of the SNES Super Scope. Did you guys?
I've seen it.
That this fucking advert, which was like this fucking telescope that you looked through and I guess shot things on your television with. I don't know.
It's gibberish. It's absolute gibberish.
I just, at the time, my brain could not handle how awesome this thing looked and how deeply, deeply remote it was that I would ever touch one, let alone like have my parents buy me one and the accompanying console.
Oh,
my God, it was so exciting.
What I've got to say, like, when I was a child, my dad took me to a Games Master Expo when they existed. Like, you could date my age, probably like 7 or something.
Did you get to touch and Dominic Diamond?
He was there. He was around. Yeah. I was aware of his presence.
Yeah, yeah.
And they had the scopes that, and they were shoulder mounted for children, like tiny children like me. And I had to climb up onto a little box to play it. And then I shot the little things and I was like, that was fine. And that's the start of my career in games criticism.
This is fine.
Unimpressed.
I give it a 72. All right. Well, I've got one more question, but not from questions, but from me. I wanted to ask you lads, if you are reading something at the moment, and if you are, what you are reading. I couldn't have phrased that more awkwardly. What are you reading at the moment? Marsh, anything? Any books?
Yeah, I'm reading the same thing I was reading in July, embarrassingly, but I put it down for a while and I picked it up again. It is Malcolm Gaskell's The Ruin of All Witches, which is Life and Death in a New World, it's subtitled. But it's a non-fiction book about essentially a witch panic followed by a witch trial that predated the Salem witch trials. And it's sort of, I mean, it is non-fiction, but it's written in quite a narrative way, which is always a bit suspicious to me. I'm like,
yeah, how did you know they thought that? Did they
exactly,
tell you?
Exactly, yes. He looked out that morning and he must have felt some, you know, the wind on his cheeks. I'm like, yeah, come on, man. But even if you strip away all of that stuff, it's full of just amazing detail about life as a colonist in the nascent America and just how difficult that was. But
having
also,
a fucking miserable time.
Yeah, having an absolutely shitty time and how that in their isolation and their religious isolation as well, because they were all people who were essentially apostates who had moved to the New World to seek greater religious freedoms. That and the way that their society was structured about through indentured servitude, essentially. All of these different things, all these things that are on themselves bad, but like sort of innocuous in a way, like you can see how they all have this gravitational effect to create absolute madness.
Yeah.
Like just all of this stuff builds resentment between neighbors. They're impoverished. They're probably starving. They probably have some sort of grain-based poisoning going on. And they're in this completely unforgiving, hostile world, which is alien and terrifying to them. And just the way that ramps up, like the paranoia and the internal conflict is just, it's of its time and very interesting for that reason. But you can see that there are universal truths about the way that people's brains operate in those kind of
societies. Yes, I was going to say, thank God those days are over.
Yeah. Well,
done tonight, Tuesday the 5th of November, 2024. Yeah.
But anyway, it's a really good book and it's in a frightful hot pink.
I can see
you wish
nice,
to pick
yeah.
it up.
That's fantastic.
Tom, have you got anything on the go at the moment, reading wise?
I do. I also brought my book for the book club. So I'm reading Never Let Me Go.
Ah,
oh, yeah.
Lovely.
By Kazuo Ishiguro. And I'm about halfway through it. And it's very difficult to talk about without spoiling anything. But to be honest, it's one of those things where it's a super, super easy read in terms of actually following the characters. They're basically children who are sequestered in a deeply sort of upper middle class kind of school, and they're there's no one, they don't have any contact with the outside world, and just people come in.
Just a perfectly normal school.
A perfectly normal, completely fine school with no problems whatsoever, where they're encouraged to never ever smoke or eat or do anything that would harm their bodies, and also to produce beautiful art that might be that is captured every so often by a deeply sinister curator who comes in and then takes that art away, and then the people whose art is taken, they are the most vaunted within that that school. But I think that's enough of a setup, because if I went further than that, it would spoil the book. It's quite upsetting.
Yeah, it's very sad. It's very, very sad.
it's quite an upsetting book. It's about but it's, even though it feels light to read and it's quite frivolous to read, and everything's painted quite quickly, and the characters basically say what they mean because often they're children, particularly the first half, then it feels as though it's not too heavy a read. But actually, what you end up with after a few hours with it is quite profound. And I would like to thank Christian Dolan, who sent me this book. He sent me a little package of books, and Christian Dolan, I really hope that our listeners are aware, should please read everything that he writes, because he's just an incredible critic and observer of games, and a really lovely person. And I interviewed him actually for this podcast a year or so ago, and I'd dearly love to have him on again. So we shall see. I'm reading that, but more frivolous things. I've been reading some graphic novels. So, Blarmay, which is like, if you're going to find it, if you can actually Google for it, BLAME !! Blame.
Oh.
Is actually what you, and it is like, along with Akira.
Oh, yes.
Nice. Of course, the classic Katsuhiro Otomo, epic, like, Neo Tokyo epic. Those two I've been reading for the despair of individuals lost in an infinite but absolutely gorgeously betrayed and sinister brutalism in terms of architecture alone. So I've been reading them. Akira's got a great story. Blame's story is not why you look at it at all. Like, the reason why you pick up Blame novels is to look at his ideas of what, like, futuristic megastructures might look like. And it's about floating things, and about, like, biology being this kind of floating thing, like gravity being optional in certain, and like his arrangements of concrete brutalist structures surrounding like gravity, and how they crack and how they fall in and pull out, and how they're built by structures. That is a really abstract way of trying to explain why it's so cool to look at, and that's why you read a graphical novel for that stuff, and you don't, and you read, you know,
you had me at mega structures.
Yeah, I've been trying to get better at like drawing and art and stuff, and I'm just like literally copying, because sometimes that's just like the best way to do it. Like, I know, like, and perspective and stuff, you know, you can do all that stuff, but actually, like, a fluid, you know, an organic form in purely rendered in perspective. There are incredible YouTube videos that actually, from great artists who do this on the fly, and you can watch them doing it, and you can see just how they've visualized exactly how everything is going to play out in pure perspective before they even start making the first line.
Sounds quite relaxing to watch.
It's incredible. Yeah, no, it is really relaxing to watch. And Jamie, I'll ping you a link to my favorite artists who do this on YouTube. YouTube is an incredible resource for this stuff as well. It's really, really cool. But yes.
Jamie?
I am a big fan of books about cults. I have read all of them now. I've read all the cult books. And some cult books are really good, like pieces of kind of amazing journalism. Some of them are just gaudy and kind of torrid, and you probably shouldn't read them. And then occasionally you get like really genuinely brilliant works of literature. So the one I've read recently is called In the Days of Rain by Rebecca Stott. Rebecca Stott's really interesting. She's written kind of quite crazy sounding books about Darwin and kind of stuff like that. She's got many, many talents and kind of writing in different fields like science and stuff like that. But this is a book about her life, and she was a member of a religious group called the Brethren, who are just, I'd heard of the Plymouth Brethren before, who were a kind of very kind of puritanical cult, but this is the Exclusive Brethren, who were kind of even worse. And it is kind of the story of her upbringing in this cult, but also tells her father's story, and he kind of rose to quite a high level in the group in the 60s and 70s. And it's got quite a lot of interesting, you know, stuff about what it's like to grow up in that world. But to be honest, it's mostly just a very, very beautifully written tale. And it's one of those things where actually the facts of it kind of fade away and the history of it kind of fade away. And it just becomes this very, very, very personal story about one's relationship to one's past and one's belief systems and one's family. And yeah, I was one of those books where every sentence kind of chills your spine with how beautiful it is. Another book in the genre, which is a book you see at like the front of the shelves in W.H. Smith's, is Tara Westover's book Educated, which is sort of similar in ways. It's about growing up in a Mormon kind of family who were a kind of cult of one guy, like the dad, and that's one of those books I would recommend to literally everyone. It's a very, very hopeful tale about escaping from dogma and kind of finding your place in the world. It's very inspirational. Like, you would happily hear about it on a Dolly Alderton podcast or something like that, but it's got legs. It's very good. So yeah, that's, oh, and I'm reading Alan Moore's new book, which I think might be called the Great When or something like that. I will check the title. It's his new, like, London is Magic kind of book. I've only just started it. I mean, he's great on this shit. Like, he's really good at thinking about magic and talking about London. Like, he did a spoken word thing called the Highbury Working a few years ago, which this actually draws from in bits and bobs. He's a funny writer in prose because he always lets his sentences run on for one metaphor longer than they should. And I mostly find it charming, but it is quite a hard frequency to tune into if you're not in the mood, you know. But
you need him growling it at you.
You need him going, the Highbury Working first. I got off the train at Charing Cross. I do a very good Alan Moore impression, by the way. I don't know what I'm talking about. Deep down in the Seven Sisters, we found ourselves in a maelstrom of fact and fiction.
Jamie, you just need like a massive beard.
Yeah.
For a start.
I need your hair.
A much, like, even for this to come down another foot off the top of my head.
Called in the sweat of the ages. Yeah. Just go off of my Alan Moore impression. But it's fine. I mean, his last book, Jerusalem, was just far too massive to countenance ever even starting. This, he said, is like seven books long, which is just standard Alan Moore. But it has a wildly entertaining first 30 pages. I can attest to that.
Did you see his, I think he did reported as a screed against fandom. In The Guardian recently.
I read
it wasn't reasonable. I thought, I don't think he was really saying anything wildly unreasonable.
It was just normal. It was just like observing the normal state of.
Yeah, I think it was fair enough. I think it's. I mean, some people in our Discord were a little bit affronted by what he was saying. I think.
Oh really?
It feels. I think some of it felt a little bit dismissive. But also, he's Alan Moore. He just says stuff.
He's always says that.
It's people come to him and ask for his opinions on like what on like adaptations of his work and stuff like that. Like, you got to stop talking to him about this. You really got to stop it. Okay, well, I guess that is all the assorted takes we have time for. I'm going to do a couple of plugs. I am going to plug Chris Thurston's book, Dark Oath, and he's just announced another book called Grombrindle, Ancestor's Burden. Yes. I got no idea what those words mean, but I assume it's going to involve
Grombrindle's
some...
big deal.
Can you explain Grombrindle to us, Tom?
Absolutely not, because that's for Chris to do in his book.
It sounds like something Scooby-Doo would say.
Grombrindle!
Exactly.
Run, Rusty's rodent. So yeah, look for those in all good black libraries near you. Friend of pod, Paul Scott Canavan, has successfully kickstarted Pale Tides, but you can still back that on Kickstarter. It looks fantastic, uniquely kind of weird folk RPG stuff. There's also Gold Teeth, which Marsh is far too modest to mention, but you can still throw money at that. Is that right, Marsh? Is that still possible?
Yes.
Kickstarter's still ongoing. And those are all the plugs. I'm going to do that. I just don't care anymore. You can send questions to the questions from questions bit on our Discord, a link for which is on our website. There's also our email address, questions@crowbar.com, but demons live there now, so I don't necessarily recommend sending anything to that. We put these on YouTube at youtube.com/crowbar. If it has a pretty image on it, it means Marsh did it. If it has an ugly one, it's me, because I don't know how to use Photoshop and just have to kind of do my best. And yeah, I think that's... Oh, and go to patreon.com/creatingcrowbar to pledge to support us and all the various bollocks that we put out under this banner. I've been Jamie Britton.
I've been Tom Senior.
I've been Marsh Davis.
Thanks
for listening, everybody.